Hello again, listener, and welcome to episode 23 of the Twinsies podcast. My name is Lucas Cook.
And I'm Dan Blewett.
And today, we're going to talk about starting out with strength training.
No, we're going to start with coffee, because I'm drinking this Steep. Is the brand name Steep?
Steep.
S-T-E-E-P. I got it from Sam's Club. It was 3 quarts, these like Tetra Pak, you know, those like square cartons. And it was 3 of them for $2.60, which is exceptional. And it's pretty good. It's like not super strong, which I don't need to be super strong. I know you had the same sentiment, but it's, I'm going to drink some right now.
Okay. Ooh, fully noise.
Slurp. Slurp. Pretty good. I enjoy this, but.
How many stars do you give it?
It's rated out of 4 coffee beans. It's 3 beans. 3 beans. For value, it's like, well, it'd be 2 beans for like taste, I think. And that's going up against
right down the
middle. Bacalam, which would be a 4.
A 4 beaner.
So it's 2, but 2 is fine. And then it's like a 4 for value for sure. So I think, you know, we'll go with our average here. We're like 3 beans.
Sam's Club is always a gamble where, like, I'm thinking of that time that you bought that bucket of cheese.
That bucket of cheese was not the way to go.
So for the listeners at home, I enjoy a nice melted cheese on my vegetables. And Dan was like, look, I got this. He literally came home with a bucket of cheese. He's like, I got this bucket of cheese at Sam's Club for like, it was something stupid cheap, like $5 or something.
Well, you were buying Cheese Whiz forever.
Cheese Whiz, and now I'm on Velveeta, but which is...
Cheese Whiz was what, $4 for a little jar?
Yeah, the jar.
8 ounce, 12 ounce like, jar or something?
Actually, I think I would buy it for $4 or $4.50, and that was on sale. Like typically
that's
it was ridiculous. Like
$5.50. Yeah, it's like not even real cheese. And then this huge like 96 ounce drum, metal steel drum, like a gallon sized can, I think it was like $7 at Sam's Club. So I'm like, even if we'll... Number one, I like playing the math. So if you get a good discount on something in bulk, you don't have to eat the whole thing. I think that's what keeps people from buying it at like Costco or Sam's Club. Where they're like, I can't eat all those carrots. Well, you're like, well, if I bought 1 pound of carrots for $1 and now I buy 3 pounds of carrots for $1.50, I don't have to eat all 3 pounds. I just need to eat a little bit more than
enough
my number
to
1 pound.
Your
to,
cost.
Yeah, to, yeah. So, you know, you can get like, I went to Aldi the other day and I got a pound of spring mix for like $3.75, which is really good. That's like $1.25 off. It's like $5 for
a
pound of, yeah, of organic spring mix or spinach. And it's like, well, I don't have to eat this whole thing. As long as I eat 3/4 of it, same cost per ounce or whatever. Of course, I did eat the whole thing. But anyway, I mean, to recoup the cost of that huge gallon of cheese, we only had to eat like 1/4 of it. I mean, not even close to that.
Right.
So we're playing the odds here, but it ended up being pretty crappy.
Yeah, and there's also a game at play where it's like, how bad does this cheese have to be for it to like
that is true.
Still lose out?
Yeah.
And it was that bad, but it was close.
Which, that's the scary thing, is I think, Sam's Club, places like that, they'll supply a lot of local restaurants because, you know, they don't all go through Sysco or one of these big companies. So they'll get their chicken fingers or their Gatorades for their vending machine at Sam's Club, which makes sense. And so I don't know. That might be in your cheesy whatever, depending on your local restaurant.
Yeah.
So beware. Beware. Ask them where they got their cheese.
Yeah. But that Sam's Club's worth it for that. Just like gamble on. And then that was a gem. You found a gem in Steep Coffee.
Yeah, it's going to be a staple. We have an espresso machine here. We have an expensive one. It costs us like $500 or $600 back in the day, which that's also recouped its cost. It's been a fantastic investment because we drink a lot of coffee. It can whip up an espresso. I can make a cappuccino, do whatever if I want to be real weird and dainty. But our espresso machine makes great coffee. However, it comes out hot. You know, it has to start and warm up and all that. And for $2.60, I don't have to buy beans. I don't have to do all that stuff. I can just grab it. It's already cold in our fridge and drink it. So there's a place for that too.
Yeah. And it's like you said, because it's slightly less flavorful, it goes down easy.
Yeah.
It's like that diner coffee. How like when you go to a breakfast place that has sort of that like mild coffee, you can just drink like gallons of it.
Yeah. It's
all this
it's the way to go.
All this talk about cheese. Update for the listener. You missed a couple days of work last week from a serious case of food poisoning.
Well,
How was that?
The story is this. My sister was in town, and naturally I had to take her to Steak and Shake because that's the most celebrated
burger place
in the Midwest. So we went to Steak and Shake. We also went to Portillo's on back-to-back days. So I went to Portillo's, I think, on Saturday, Steak and Shake on Sunday. I had a 7x7 naturally, put it away with ease. My sister got like a weird guacamole burger, which I was sort of upset inside about, but you know, it's her preference.
Mm-hmm.
And then my sister was here through Monday, And on Monday, I woke up and she was flying back out on at about 5 p.m. So we had the day together and we went to yoga class and I just didn't feel good. I just felt ill the whole morning. Just like, and I have like an iron stomach. I almost never get sick enough where I'll puke. I have a tummy ache like twice a year, maybe. Like I have a really good stomach. So anyway, I feel bad the whole first half of the day. We go to yoga together because she's big into yoga. We were, spending brother-sister time. So
sure.
Didn't get any better. Not that yoga was going to cure my stomach, but that night I just felt horrible. I had a fever. It felt like I had the flu. I mean, like flu-like symptoms for sure. And I was just pounding Pedialyte trying to like get better in a jiffy. So the next day, 2 days later, my sister texts me. I'm a little bit on the mend. I'm feeling good enough to come back into work. She's like, hey, have you been hugging the toilet for the last day? I'm like, maybe.
Maybe.
And so I've been, like, people were asking, like, well, what do you have? I'm like, I don't know, probably just, like, a little stomach flu. I don't know, a little, like, 24-hour thing. And then once my sister texted me, I was pretty sure it was food poisoning.
Eureka moment. The blast puzzle piece fell in place.
You know, and this is one of those weird situations where I love Portillo's. I also love Steak and Shake. Like, they're equally, they hold equal esteem in my heart. And then the other place that we ate, where was it? We also had a bunch of cookie dough, just like raw cookie dough. Which I do not. Salmonella is largely a myth. You get salmonella from 1 in 10,000 eggs. Like it's extremely rare. So the likelihood I had cookie dough was that got me sick was very slim. But anyway, those are the three things on our list of things that potentially poisoned us.
Right.
Cookie dough, Steak and Shake, Portillo's. And this is where your biases as a human come in, where it's like, I love Portillo's so much and it's new. And I only eat Italian beef when I go there. I don't buy anything else. And it's like, I don't want it to be Portillo's, so I'm just gonna make it. All right, look, Steak and Shake is a fast food restaurant. We'll just go ahead and assume that it was Steak and Shake. You know, we're not gonna break up over this anyway, so like, I'll still go back there. But I just want to. I don't want to believe that it was Portillo's for a minute. Could have been. No idea. You really can't. Those variables are hard to isolate anyway. I'm pretty sure it wasn't cookie dough because I had to come in on Tuesday night for 1 hour because we didn't have anyone to cover the last strength session, and I hadn't eaten anything all day. I barely ate anything all Monday. So I just need like some quick calories. So naturally, I had some cookie dough left over. Right, so yeah. I threw about four cookies down the hatch. And if that was the culprit, I would have had a recurrence. I would have had another bout of food poisoning. But
eliminated that variable.
So, or maybe I just built a tolerance. Maybe the first, that was like a vaccine.
Your body's like, oh, we know. We've been down this road.
So I don't know. The human body's tricky. But yeah, it's been a rough week.
Yeah.
But I was going to compare this coffee to La Colombe, which I didn't send you the article, but La Colombe coffee is like my favorite thing. It's a Philadelphia company. I really respect the owner. I've read a bunch of articles on him and his like vision for his company. And I in general tend to like patronize businesses that I have some intel on that I like.
Feel like. Yeah. And they're killing it too over the last couple of years.
Yeah. And one of the reasons is their draft latte. So it's this little canned beverage. It's about the same shape and size as a Red Bull can. But it's got this weird plastic lid that's kind of like gentle, and it's got this. So the draft latte was his. I learned this the other day. I was going to share it with you, but I forgot. He wanted to find a solution as iced coffee became a trend in his cafes. So people would come in, they'd want a cold coffee, but they want a latte. How do they get a cold latte? And there's like no good way to prepare a latte and then make it cold.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you can steep cold brew coffee and all that. It's a lot easier, but he didn't have a good way to do that. So what he was trying to figure out is how he could have like cold lattes on tap. So it would require making lattes ahead of time and yet keeping the frothy like consistency that people like about it on tap. So he did. And then, so he had this out of a big like keg basically. And so I actually got one on Wednesday morning. I was in Chicago. But so you can go to La Colombe and you can get a draft latte. Well, he'll pull it out just like a beer, but then they also canned it. But he didn't know how he could put this in the can and then the frothy texture of the milk would stay. And so I was reading this article. I was just kind of like searching about it because my sister's husband owns a brewery and they actually have their own canned coffee beverage. And so we were talking about it. I'm like, I don't know how they do that. And I don't know what the origin of this weird plastic thing is on the top of their can. So I was reading about it and basically his wife, the guy Todd Carmichael, who owns La Colombe, she hates drinking out of cans. So she's like, A, if you make this, honey, like I don't want to drink out of a can. I don't want that metallic taste or the feel of it. So he made this plastic like cap that goes on top. So and it's just rounded. So like the lid of the can just sort of mimics the lip of a coffee cup. So kind of interesting, just more like an aesthetic thing.
Well, and I had also read that I thought that there was some sort of, I don't know if it was a chemical change, but like there was like some, the contact with the aluminum can, like right as it's going into your mouth, like changes the taste of the coffee. So he didn't want that either. Like that, he wanted to pass over the plastic rather than...
That might be true. That wasn't in the article that I read, but that sounds true too. But the other interesting thing is that there's a little thing in the bottom of the can that's embedded in it. And they said it has nitric oxide either in it or... I don't know. It was kind of fuzzy how they explained it. But basically, when you pop the can, this little valve in the bottom of the can shoots nitrous oxide into the can, and that immediately froths it when you pop the top.
Weird.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
So did he come up with that?
He came up with that.
So he has like the patent on that?
Yeah.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
I got to send you that article.
Have you,
yeah,
cut open, a can yet?
Obviously. Obviously. Okay. I did.
I was about to say, I want to do that right now.
At the very bottom, it's just like this, looks like a little button, like almost like a candy button. Was that what they were called? Yeah. Or
like
candy.
Like a gumdrop?
No. You could buy like this strip of things called, I thought they were called candy buttons, but I don't know. But it's about like a quarter inch in diameter. It's kind of rubbery. And on the bottom of the can, it's not aluminum colored. There's like a plastic, it looks like they shoved like a pog in the bottom. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some sort of like plastic thing in the bottom of the can that keeps you from like tampering with the thing at the bottom of it.
Mm.
Or like, and you so can't see the valve. You'd have to pry that plastic, I think, out of it.
It's clearly like pressure activated then?
Yeah, I guess so. Weird. I don't know much about the technology, but they briefly explained it. And it was a little, like I said, still a little confusing about
how it actually works. A lot of technology in that can.
Yeah, he invented the technology to froth a beverage in a can.
Good for him.
Yeah, that's why I really like their company, because, I mean, just cool technology, and just like he's passionate about what he does and is trying to find a way to get it to people and not just have these same like flat, crappy coffee beverages.
I was on my way back from Tuscaloosa, Alabama this weekend, and I stopped in the middle of nowhere, Kentucky, in like, imagine like exactly what you're thinking about. A gas station in the middle of nowhere, Kentucky. That's what this gas station was. And I went back to get a bottle of water, and lo and behold, up top row of the coffee section was Lac Lum. And I was like, what? Who's buying Lac Lum out here in Kentucky?
Well, yeah, even just 2 years ago, they weren't, like, I couldn't find them out here, but now they have them at Target. I'm not sure where else in town they have them here in Bloomington, Illinois, but they're expanding their network. Yeah. And even when I was up there this weekend, they had like all the different flavors in a bunch of different places that we went. So.
Well, there you have it. And that conversation about coffee is a perfect segue into talking about how we introduce our clients to strength training for their first visit. So we, around this time of year, it always seems that this is when things start to escalate in the gym. So in the month of September, things are pretty slow. You have junior high baseball and softball are in season. High school volleyball is in season. Our high school baseball players typically take at least the month of September off to kind of step away from the gym and baseball to recover after their summer season and school season. And so that leaves like a very small clientele in the gym in September. But then when October rolls around and all those junior high sports are ending, people start to come back. Inevitably, we get a lot of new clients, especially younger clients, junior high, it seems, that start up in October. So we thought that we would spend today talking about when someone shows up for the first time, what we do in our first couple of workouts with them and what we look for, especially as it pertains to assessment. I was just recently recertifying for my CSCS, which is a strength certification, and in the process was reading through some stuff. And one of the things that continues to be lauded as an assessment tool is what's called the functional movement screen, which was essentially this test developed by this guy named Greg Cook, and it's goal is to provide a systematic way to assess someone's functional movement. And I'm doing air quotes.
Yes, he is.
And so one of the things that research has shown is this tool, this FMS tool, which, by the way, we do not use. We'll talk about why here in a second. This tool itself would be a great way to quantitatively assess someone's ability to move. But the problem that occurs is it's all reliant upon the person administering the screen. So what they're finding is that when you have five different strength coaches administering this test, basically, to give you an idea, you perform these movements, I think there's seven of them, and then you get rated on a scale of 1, 2, or 3. So if you're a 3, you're crushing it. If you're 1, you're not very good. And so what they're finding out is all of these people proctoring the exams, it's all completely contingent upon that individual instructor's rating system. So rating's not consistent amongst different.
Yeah. So I think inter-rater reliability.
Yeah. So inherently the problem you run into is that kind of devalues it as, I mean, its job is to be objective and systematic. And so when it's not, when it turns into something subjective, then it doesn't really work anymore. So we've never really done that. Not to mention you've done the FMS and you're not a big fan of it because.
Well, I did it as an athlete in 2012 with the Evansville Otters. And it was a very frustrating experience for me because, I mean, here's the thing. As a strength coach, say you get a brand new kid who's never, and that's one of the things we get a lot of, we get a ton of brand new athletes who've never lifted a weight. We get a lot of young boys and girls. Again, this is their first crack at ever doing anything. So for us to ask them, say, hey, can you give me a squat? They've never squatted before. They don't know what we're looking for. They don't know what good form looks like. So they're going to squat. We could say, oh, that squat form is ugly. The FMS tells me that they've got poor hip mobility because they didn't go very low. Well, maybe they don't know how low they're supposed to go, mm-hmm. right? So when I was with Evansville, again, this is my third year as a pitcher in pro ball, they gave the whole team the FMS to hopefully like give them an idea if there are any like, injury risks, because for an independent ball, an injury risk means that, they might be on the hook for a bigger workers' comp claim or something like that. So them just trying to be, I guess, good old boys, just trying to figure out what their risk might be. So I am extremely flexible for my size. I'm like a more muscular than average. I'm 6 foot, I'm 200 pounds. And I'm pretty flexible. So most of these things, and I spend a lot of time on my mobility. Obviously, I am a strength coach, so I train myself throughout my career. So I'm like most of these tests, very good at them. I'm very strong, very flexible, very mobile, all that stuff. Figured I would do pretty well. And I did reasonably well, but I was frustrated in the fact that on all these tests, they ran all like 30 guys in spring training through this test. They gave us no coaching on them. They just said, okay, here's how you do it. They like one guy would demonstrate it. And then you get one crack at it. So one of them like was like this hurdle step over where I was supposed to step over the hurdle with one leg and then come down and then like step back. And there was a couple others. And if you only get one chance. So I do it once and I like hit the hurdle and I get a 2. And I do another thing and I like lose my balance and then I get a 1 instead of a 3. And it's like, wait, are you really measuring if I'm flexible or strong or balanced enough to do this? Or are you rating if I can do it on the very first try with no coaching or without having tried it? So if I did the whole thing one time, which I did, I got like a average score. I got like a little above average. But if you were to give me a whole second crack at it, like having done it once and knowing what they're looking for, I would have done significantly better. So then you're asking yourself, what is the point? Is it to see what an athlete can do naturally? Or is it to see what he can do naturally with a little bit of instruction, which I think the goal is with instruction. You don't want to figure out like, oh, this kid can't squat when he's never squatted before. And he doesn't know what you're looking for. He doesn't know like what the criteria are. So for me, it was frustrating. And again, like just because I like lost my balance and like kicked the hurdle over, does that mean I don't have the flexibility to do it? Isn't that what you're measuring? Or is it just that like I screw that one up? I don't know.
Something analogous here would be if we have a kid come in, we say, hey, Timmy, do a squat, and Timmy squats down. He comes back up, and you see his knees buckle in. So his knees valgus collapse in, and you're like, ooh, he's got weak hips. But then on the second one, you're like, hey, do that again. Try holding your knees out, and then he does it like a champion. It's like, well, clearly he has the hip strength to do
it. Yeah,
he just like needed to be told to do it.
Yeah, there's a lot of context that it requires. And another example was we had a kid who had some knee pain, like 3 or 4 years ago, and this was a kid who could front squat 275 with good form. And to front squat, which is a quad dominant version of the squat because you're very upright, that's hard. And for a high schooler to do 275 with good form is exceptional. It's very, very good. And so he has some knee pain. It starts to get a little bit chronic. So he goes to the doctor and they do the FMS on him. And they're like, well, he's got weak quads. And we're like, so wait, his knee pain is caused by weak quads, but the quads are the prime mover of a front squat, and he front squats significantly more than the average high school kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how, again, does he have weak quads?
Yeah, weak quads relative to who?
Yeah, exactly. So they laid him on a table, like chest down, like face down, And then they like lift him up, or he like pushes down with his leg. It's like they're basically like isolating him and forcing his quad to do something that he's like never done. And they're determining that he's weak quads based on that. Whereas with a real world functional exercise, which I hate using the word functional, but squatting is, you know, good exercise that sort of gives you an idea of overall body strength, he excels at. So which test is telling us that this kid has weak quads? He right. didn't have weak quads. If you had weak quads, you can't front squat 275.
Right.
So that was a frustrating experience where it's like, look, they're trying to do these tests because they want to figure out, does this person have some deficiency that we can find, that we can screen out, that might be giving them pain, that might be causing their knee pain? And that's a worthwhile goal, but we just can't always isolate it, especially in young kids who are growing, who are learning new things, who might be doing multiple sports and eating too little and sleeping too little and being stressed out from all the stuff that they have going on. It's hard to say that just his weak quads cause his knee pain, because that was clearly not the case with him. He had a lot of other stuff going on, and the exercises that they gave him didn't do any good for him either.
Right. And so the problem here is you go, okay, well, there's this FMS that everybody uses, and we're supposed to use it as an assessment tool, but we don't like it. So when Sally shows up for her first day in the gym, because one of the things we pride ourselves on is when someone comes to our gym, at some point they are written a workout program customized for them. Now, peek behind the curtain, 85% of the stuff that we write, everybody needs. And then there's like sort of like a 20 to 15% wiggle room where, yeah, we can specialize for, you know, this particular sport or this particular movement, whatever it is. But most people need most of the same stuff. So when Sally shows up for her first day of strength training, how do we determine what we need to program in her strength program to hit her weaknesses? And what we do is, we have what's called an introductory workout sheet, and it includes some of the bigger multi-joint movements that they're going to perform in the gym, and we use those kind of as a diagnostic to figure out what this person needs. And so probably the most classic example of this is a goblet squat. So in a goblet squat, you're holding a dumbbell, you're holding it by the head of the dumbbell, which is the end, and we ask you to perform a squat, go all the way to the bottom, which for us is when your hip gets just below your knee, and then come back up to the top. And that movement alone, after it's properly coached, can tell you a ton. And so there are a couple classic examples of these. One of them I already gave you, which is, let's say you have someone, they squat down, and then as soon as they hit the bottom of the squat and they go to come back up, their knees cave in big time. And you say, okay, let's do a couple more of these, see if you can hold your knees out better. And they still can't. That's an indication that person has weak lateral hips, so they can't externally rotate their legs. Or let's say you're cueing them to sit their butt back. So sit their butt back like they're going to sit into a chair, and they just can't quite do it. Maybe they can't keep their heels down. That might be an indication that person has weak hamstrings and doesn't have the hamstring strength to really sit back into their squat. Let's say their lower half looks great, but they've got a 20-pound dumbbell and they just can't keep their chest up, and their chest keeps caving in towards the ground. That person has a weak back. So over the course of three sets of 12 squats, you can tell a lot based on someone's strength by how they're performing the reps. And I know you and I went to the Hammer Strength Clinic in Colorado Springs last year, and Matt Winning was talking about, you know, he can watch someone do 5-6 squats and instantly tell just by how they move where their weak areas are.
Yeah, and we don't see, and that's the other thing that, I mean, everyone needs context because everyone trains different people. So we train 99% young athletes, which with the median age being probably 14. So most of these kids don't have mobility problems. They have weakness right. problems. We almost never do hip mobility drills at all. And they're all the rage in like the squat community, the fitness community, like, oh, you need more hip mobility. That's not why you're not getting down low enough. We almost never do them, but we do tons and tons and tons of hamstring and back assistant work. So when kids get stronger hamstrings, suddenly it's like magic that they can squat to depth with a really good form. So it's usually not mobility, it's usually strength, and it's often coaching too. So this, the like assessment of mobility and flexibility thing, especially in the younger athlete population, like it's what, like, why are these kids going to have tightness? Like they're like newborn baby deer.
Right.
You don't come out tight, you come out loose. And these kids have, you know, they have open growth plates when they're like younger, like 10, 11, 12, they have more space in their joints than an older kid does. So tightness is never their problem. If they can't touch their toes or they can't squat to depth, it's weakness. It's always weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know for a fact that, well, not for a fact, but the better people in the industry, they talk about the FMS not as the only thing. Like, they talk about it and like, look, it's got some merit, but it needs to be in context. Like, most of the guys who are really smart, they might use it or they might not. But if they do use it, they don't use it as the only thing. They just like use it as like a little bit of a guide, you know? Yeah, and that's the good way to do it, I think.
And I was recently listening to someone speak on it, and the woman who was speaking was very intelligent and, from what I could tell, a very good strength coach. And she was swearing by it, not by this is the only thing you can possibly do, but she was just like, I need something quantitative, and this is like as good as it gets. And it's mm-hmm. like, okay, well, I get it. But our...
Man, you just dropped your laptop bag.
I dropped our... What's that stuff called that we were going to try to waterproof our stuff?
Nicorac or something? It's DWR, durable waterproof or water repellent.
Yeah. We're going to try... We got new bucket hats. We're going to try to make them rain repellent.
I want everything that I own to be water repellent.
There's also that stuff called Never Wet. Have you ever seen that? No. You put on your shoes? Oh, okay. But anyway, our introductory exercise program is filled with exercises like this. And another classic example is a push-up and a row. So in a push-up, asking them to, you know, with their forearms staying vertical, can you go down and then maintain a big chest, pulling your shoulders back, have a tight belly, have a tight butt, and push yourself back up, doing one full complete push-up. And the amount of kids that come in with the ability to do a really solid push-up on the floor aren't that many. They can do what are called like maybe PE class push-ups where their elbows flare out and their back's round. But that's another really good tool where it's if we have a kid day one who comes in and can do a flawless push-up on the ground, they're strong.
It's probably 1 in 10 boys and 1 in 30 girls.
Yeah, I would say that's probably accurate.
Yeah.
And the same kind of thing works with an inverted row. And if you don't know what an inverted row is, it's just imagine almost the exact opposite of a push-up. So you're facing the ceiling and you have you're sort of hanging on ropes and you have to pull yourself up. And the amount of kids that we see come in with really strong backs and really strong scapular control where they can really like pull their shoulders back and squeeze their shoulder blades. And the cue I always use is, you know, if someone came up and poked you in your spine, if you can squeeze their fingers with your shoulder blades, that's what we're talking about. And the amount of kids that can do that and really pull their shoulders back, that's another really infrequent strength level. And so lunges are another big one. So you referenced baby deer earlier, and we have a lot of kids that weren't doing lunges. They look like baby deers where their knees are all wobbly and mm-hmm. they can't quite stand up straight, even with like low load. So they're holding 10-pound dumbbells and they can't keep their torso vertical while they're doing a lunge. And so that's worked really, really well for us where we've gotten to the point now where we've done so many that when a kid walks through the door, we can look at their shoulders, we can look at, you know, their hamstring development and their butt and be like, oh, you know, this person probably needs the same stuff that the last 500 kids needed. And that is they need to have stronger hamstrings, they need to have a stronger butt, need to have a stronger back, need better shoulder stability, knee stability, lateral hip strength. And the amount of kids that come in and don't fit that mold are the exceptions, not the rule in most cases.
Yeah, and it's, you know, one of those situations where we also don't get too nitpicky about it because I feel like especially on the online community, people are super nitpicky about exercise technique. And we post videos of our athletes all the time on Instagram. We complain about this in one of our very first podcasts. But, you know, I'll put a photo or a video of a young boy or girl doing a exercise with pretty good form. Like their back looks really good or whatever. The big things that would prevent injury, they're doing really, really well. Those are the big things we're concerned with. Like when we scan our room, we don't want to see anyone doing anything that might hurt them. But within that, there's lots of little cues. So if you're doing a Romanian deadlift, an RDL, for example, you need to have your feet about hip width apart. You need to stay flat on the ground. Your butt needs to travel back. Your knees need to have a slight amount of bend. Your back needs to stay straight. Your stomach needs to stay tight. Your shoulder blades need to stay back. There's a lot of different cues. Every exercise has like 10 or 12 different things, but a lot of them are small things that aren't, you're not going to get hurt if you don't do certain things. So like there was an example recently, a girl was doing a trap deadlift and her back looked great. Like the big important things about her form looked great. She was really arching her neck back. And of course, we got a bunch of comments on Instagram like, oh, why is she pulling her neck back? You got to fix her neck. Like, she needs to be looking. It's like, dude, no one cares. No one's ever hurt their neck looking up to the ceiling when they're doing a deadlift. Is it ideal? No. But is she doing a great job? Yes. And will I correct her at some point with that? Sure. But definitely not a priority for today. I'm not going to like get in her ear about some tiny little detail when we've been working hard with her over time to get her where she is now. Like, we just try to give kids one or two things on each set to improve on without barking at them, without, you know, just constantly being on their case, because you don't want to feel unsuccessful when you're just starting to learn how to lift.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say that I think that approach has been integral to our success, because especially if you look at, you know, you're a 10-year-old boy or you're a 12-year-old girl and you're just starting strength training and you come into our gym and it's kind of grungy and there's like chalk laying around, there's some rusty barbells and it's kind of intimidating. The last thing you
spiders.
Want, there's spiders, there's a big bald guy walking around. The last thing you want is get done with your workout set and just feel like you failed on every lift. Yes, we want our clients to perform lifts perfectly. That's the ideal situation, but you have to be patient. They have to be taught that over time, where in your first day when you come, we're not going to just like blast you to the point where you're like, I never want to go back. They made me feel terrible. And so I think that's a lot of strength coaches, I think, either A, especially in the, oh my God, especially in the internet community, but either A, haven't trained that demographic or aren't very good at their jobs. And I think, or maybe they're dealing with like a higher level clientele where like you can yell at somebody for an hour and they're still going to come back, but not to a 10-year-old.
Yeah. And it's just like with baseball and softball skills or volleyball skills or basketball skills, you wouldn't expect a kid to perfect his jump shot the first time he came in, or even the first week or the first month. It takes time, right? It takes time to get those high level skills, you know. And then think about weightlifting. They're not learning just a swing or just, you know, a spike or just, you know, how to tackle properly or how to do, you know, a golf swing. It's not just one skill. They're learning 12 exercises on this month's program. Then they're learning 10 new ones next month. Like, that's a lot of stuff. So mm-hmm. you have 12 exercises. Actually, you know, most of our kids have 6 exercises each day plus 4 more of like shoulder care if they're baseball, softball, or volleyball. So they have 10 exercises every day, and then there's usually about 30% overlap. So on a given monthly program, if they're doing 3 lifts a week, they're going to have 24 different exercises, 20
mm-hmm.
maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so each of those exercises maybe has 10 different like coaching cues, you know, head up, eyes forward, shoulders back, stomach tight, butt tight, knees out, feet flat, sit back, stay back, all that stuff. 200 things they have to remember.
Right.
Like, we can't expect them to be perfect. Like, just let them get, and I watch kids every day do push-ups with not correct form. But when I'm looking for, okay, he did it. 8 out of 10 things were correct last time. Today, 9 out of 10 are correct. I'll let him keep going. I see one thing that I don't like, but I'm not going to get in his ear about it again. Like, he's making progress, and progress is what matters.
Right. Okay. Well, we cut this podcast kind of close to our strength training, so we're probably going to wrap up here. Now, are you gesturing to being a special guest?
Hunter just walked in. He was our feature Instagram. Let me see if I can go find him.
Okay.
We'll get him on here. All right. So here we have Hunter. Hunter, how old are you?
13.
And Hunter, you were featured on our Instagram the other day. Farmers walking with 90-pound dumbbells. What did you start farmers walking with on your first day here?
I think 25 pounds.
25?
Yeah.
So would it be safe to say that you've progressed over the years?
Yes.
And what do you feel like you worked on first? Were you focused on more weight first, or was it something else?
I think more weight, yeah.
That was the wrong answer, Hunter. I was queuing you up to say that you focused on technique first and you got stronger over time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that happened, I guess.
That happened. So you started with 25s.
great, Hunter.
Yeah,
great job.
Yeah, making me look like a chump here. Yeah. Having me on the podcast.
Regret the decision immediately.
No, but Hunter is, so you're 13. He's on our 14 U Senators team. The other day you did trap deadlift for
205, right?
Yeah.
How many reps?
6.
6 reps.
And you're farmers walking with 90s.
And you weigh, how much do you weigh?
140.
All right. So the man weighs 140. Farmers walking with 180. Trap deadlifting 205.
1.5 times body weight for 6 reps.
Yeah, which is super strong for his age. So, I mean, what are the things that you, what are your goals when you're in the, when you're in our gym? Obviously, I know you like lifting heavy weights. I know you like doing all that, but you're focused on technique and all that stuff too. So like, what's your little checklist when you go through and you start a set?
Make sure like my form's good so I can get like the most out of each one, and then add weight as it gets harder and easier.
Okay, so there you go.
As it gets harder and easier.
Harder and easier. And that's the thing, when you add more weight over time, it never gets easy if you push yourself, right?
Right.
So your workouts are pretty consistent from day to day?
Yeah.
Also, I don't think anyone appreciates that 90-pound dumbbells on farmer's walks?
That's heavy even for me.
That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. Hunter, excellent job, sir. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
He's nodding. He's nodding to those podcast land. All right. We'll work on it. After this is done, we'll review what could we have done better. That's okay.
Classic.
Good for sure.
Classic Hunter.
All right. So with that, we got to wrap up. We're about to start strength training. Dan, do you have any parting thoughts?
No, but I feel like that was a classic 13-year-old interview right there.
I mean, that's, you get what you pay for.
I gotta brush up my interviewing skills.
Hey, it was spontaneous. It was on the spot.
It was. Hunter's a good kid. He works hard.
All right. We'll see you next time on Twinsies.
Peace.